You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Bill Galston, a senior fellow here at Brookings in the Governance Studies program, and I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome you to the opening of event for 2011-2012 of the long-running hit series Governance Studies, which is one of the proud products of the Governing Ideas. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. That's the name of the series, which is one of the proud projects of the Governance Studies program. And please stay tuned for further announcements. The Brookings website will try to give you timely notice of all further events in this series. There are many events at Brookings that happen almost by accident. This is not one of them. Indeed, you know, for the Freudians among you, this event is overdetermined. We have, first of all, a center on the United States and Europe here at Brookings, whose research director, Justin Vase, is with us, a graduate of Sciences Po himself. And in addition to the Governing Ideas series in Governance Studies, we also have in the Governance Studies program a project on religion and American public life. And on a more personal note, it's a pleasure to be able to return Denis Lacorne's hospitality, which I have enjoyed more than once in his splendid city. I'll introduce both of our speakers in just a minute, but first, a word about the book, which is the focal point of this event, with a ringingly Tocquevillian title, and I think quite deliberately so, of Religion in America. This book brings together two topics. First of all, the ongoing but mutable role of religion in American politics and public life. And secondly, more than two centuries of French efforts to understand that role. France and the United States have long been fascinated with each other, but all too often, the attention that each country has lavished on the other has yielded little except mutual incomprehension. The two countries, after all, share a parent, namely the Enlightenment. Could it be the identity of the other parents that helps to explain our differences? And if not, what could be the explanation? Denis Lacorne is perfectly situated to help us understand such questions. You have the full biographies for both our speaker, Denis Lacorne, and our commentator, Patrick Deneen, in your packets, and I won't waste your time by reviewing them in detail. Let me just pull out some salient facts about each of these distinguished scholars. Beginning with Denis, and here I must look to you, Denis, for an updating. Are you still research director? Then I don't have to change anything. Denis Lacorne is director of research at Sciences Po. He specializes in the political history of the United States. I think it is no exaggeration whatsoever to say that Denis is now the single most distinguished French commentator of, on, and scholar of American politics and America's distinctive political culture. And he joined the Center for International Studies at and research, Série, for its devotees at Sciences Po nearly 30 years ago. Denis is a graduate of Sciences Po, among other institutions. He has a PhD in political science from Yale, and if I've done my sums correctly, he has actually spent many, many years resident in the United States, more than a decade, I think. And so he comes by his feel for America quite honestly and as the product of long and deliberate labors. Patrick Deneen, our commentator, is an associate professor of government at Georgetown University. And now I'm going to hold my breath and hope I get this right. He holds the Marcos and Eleni Tsakopoulos Kunakalis Chair in Hellenic Studies. How did I do, Patrick? And Patrick is a well-known political theorist who's published and edited a number of books in the area of political theory. But even more to the point for this afternoon's proceedings, about 5 years ago, he became the founding director of the Tocqueville Forum on the Roots of American Democracy, which is an initiative that seeks to extend our understanding of the United States' founding principles and the roots of those principles, not only in Western philosophical traditions, but also in our religious traditions. So that makes him a near-perfect commentator on this book, I believe. And we're going to proceed briskly. Denis LeCorne will offer us about 25 minutes of reflections on his book and its topic. Patrick Deneen will offer comments for 10 to 15 minutes. If time permits, there will be moderated crosstalk. And if time does not permit, we will go straight to your questions because this is a distinguished and interested audience and you deserve to have your say. And we will conclude at about 3:30. And so without further ado, on with the show.
Thank you so much for this very flattering presentation. Last time, I often travel to the United States, but not that often to Washington, D.C., and the last time I was here was maybe about 10 years ago to buy a book, which was the beginning of my research, by a member of the Brookings, a book by James Reichley, Religion in American Public Life, which was a very useful source for me. Is there a problem with the speaker? Or
I think perhaps
too close, too far?
Perhaps you need to be closer to
closer?
It. Yes.
Is this better for the... Oh, okay. It's always been surprising for me whenever I return to the United States, which is about twice a year, sometimes more, to find how prevalent is the place of religion in politics in this country. Last summer, I was in California, and there was much talk about Governor Perry's Day of Prayer response, in which he decided to... in which he said, among other things, he declared his love, quote, for the living Christ, which, of course, would make a non-Christian, or for that matter, a Catholic, uncomfortable. And so the challenge, then, is to explain the coexistence of what I think are two opposed trends. One is a tradition that incites American politicians to talk about religion, to talk openly about their faith, and incite them to promote religion, religious symbols in the public space, and another tradition that insists on the necessity to preserve a separation between church and state. And so the book is an attempt to look at those competing values, if you wish, and put them in a long historiographic context perspective, also a comparative perspective. And so what matters for me is not religion in itself, as an isolated phenomenon, but I would say the uses of religion by political leaders and intellectuals in order to create or reinvent or redescribe a national identity. And of course, it's always difficult to talk about national identities. They're not easy to define, and they're the object of numerous controversies, of course. And there's an added difficulty in the American case, which has to do with the, how to put it, the political chronology. I like to quote John Muirhead, the great historian, who once said that the problem in the United States is that the constitutional roof was built before national walls. It took over a century to solidify those national walls. And the argument then is the following, my argument. From a European perspective, it seems to me that if one looks at an early narrative of identity building in the United States, I see two rival narratives. The first one, I could call it the creation story of a secular republic, which had a lot in common with French republican ideas of the time, and promoting key principles of equality, sovereignty of the people, hierarchy of laws, separation of church and state, and so on. And then a second principle, which I call neo-Puritan or sometimes romantic, which really became fashionable a little later in the first third of the 19th century, and which denies the secular nature of the American government and gives tremendous importance to the Pilgrims and the Puritans, a creation story, if you wish, which was redeveloped by, first of all, New England historians, but in the 19th century by American Whig historians, John Quincy Adams, Daniel Webster, but also Bancroft, the very influential author of a 10-volume history of the United States. And at the same time, Tocqueville also was very much interested in that development, and here I'm referring to Chapter 2 of Democracy in America, which is on the point of departure of the American democracy. So let me start with the first narrative. And what I'll do is essentially give a definition of the two narratives. And then the second part of my talk is about the modernization or the revival of those narratives today in the 20th century and the 21st century. I will not talk much about the second half of the 19th century or early 20th century. Enlightenment philosophers cared about religion, but their perspective was also terribly critical of religion. Religion could lead to fanaticism and fanaticism to civil war. And I could give numerous examples of Enlightenment philosophers denouncing zealots. Even John Locke, take John Locke's letters concerning toleration, is shocked at the excesses of the Calvinists in Geneva. He's very shocked at the he calls it the bloody violence that led to the execution of Michel Servet. Many other writers have denounced excesses. Voltaire, of course, is the most typical example, and I will refer to his Examen de Milord Bolingbroke that came out in 1736, where he attacks, quote, the stupidity of fanaticism and of old Christian millenarians that he called Christicole, who accepted literally, quote, the Book of Revelation and made, quote, the demented prediction that a new Jerusalem should descend upon the earth. The result of such fanaticism was that Europe was drowned in an ocean of blood. And I could multiply the examples of that nature. Abbé Raynal, in his famous History of the Two Indies, republished many times in the 1780s, it's about the settlement in the Americas and in North America, has very strong terms against the New England Puritans. He admits that on the one hand they did great things, but on the other he finds them absolutely vicious and dangerous, for they were civilized men who, even though they were helped by American Indians at first, did not hesitate to murder peaceful Indians a little later. And he talks about Captain Lovewell and so on and so forth. And what does he say? Here's a quote from Raynal. Were you Christians? He's talking to American Puritans. And his answer, no, you are monsters of extermination. And then he draws a fascinating comparison between Puritans and conquistadors and doesn't see any difference between the two of them. Now, there are exceptions. Some religions are admired and praised by French authors, and the key one is the Quakers, Quakerism. And Voltaire's philosophical letters is full of praise for the Quakers, but it's really, is it a religion or is it a religion for a non-religious age? And I think the second is the answer. He admires William Penn because he created, quote, a government without priests. And what he loves about Quakerism is that it's really an anti-Catholicism. There's no communion. There's no confession. There's none of what you have. So for him, it's a utopian of a non-religious, utopia of a non-religious religion. And it's at that time you have a fascinating dialogue between American elites and French elites. And the one example I'll give, there are others, but is Desmonniers. Desmonniers was the secretary of Monsieur. Monsieur was the brother of Louis XVI. He was a lawyer himself and is the author of this new encyclopedia that comes after Diderot's encyclopedia. It's called Encyclopédie Méthodique. It starts with seven volumes, and then it will continue later in the 19th century. And Desmonniers in the 1780s is absolutely fascinated by what happens in North America, and particularly by the Virginia debates, by Jefferson's bill for establishing religious freedom, which did not pass as a law until 1786. And it's translated the year of its passage, fully translated, and debated in France. And what fascinates the French, 1786, 3 years before the French Revolution, is the disestablishment of the Anglican Church, the fact that all oaths of religions are abolished in Virginia, and that no tax is collected for a particular church in Virginia. So what we have is a very interesting debate 3 years before the Revolution on the separation of church and state, where Virginia is kind of perceived as a model. And, of course, a model that's pushed by Jefferson because he happens to be the ambassador of the United States to France. Well, technically, plenipotentiary, the ministre plenipotentiaire didn't have quite the title of ambassador, but that was very much the same. Now, I could give you many other examples. Another example of this transatlantic discussion about secular values would be, well, this Tom Paine, obvious example, but different members of the Scottish Enlightenment. And the least known, perhaps, is James Burgh, who wrote a credo, it's a two volumes of essays about the necessity to privatize church functions. And what's fascinating about credo, the second volume is dedicated to the good people of Britain of the 20th century. It's a utopian novel, but of course that's what you write when you want to criticize the King of England, not be arrested. So you situate your criticism in a distant future. And that's where he talks of the necessity, that's his advice he gives to the people of Britain of the 20th century, called build an impenetrable wall of separation between things sacred and civil. And that's the expression, so it is argued by a very good legal historian who lives in the city, Daniel Dreisbach. It's likely that Jefferson found the term wall of separation after reading Crito. We know that Jefferson owned a copy of Crito and read it. Let me now consider the second narrative, which I call neo-Puritan and sometimes romantic. Now, here, put yourself at the beginning, the first third of the 19th century. The French Revolution has failed. It's considered not a good example. It's a failure of reason. It's a failure in the Enlightenment. And it's a time when you have a new romantic imagination that praises the virtues of religion, emotion, tradition, and also rediscovers great heroes in a very distant past, the Saxons, the Gauls, the Germanic tribes in the forest of Germany, as described by Tacitus, for instance. There's a passion for that, and it's a moment when political values or political foundation are kind of forgotten, and the emphasis is put on the character of a nation or the spirit of a nation, and the German will say the Volksgeist of a nation. And it, in many ways, beautifully illustrated by Tocqueville in Democracy in America, where he talks also about the character of a nation, and he says, it is contained in its origin, quote, in a matter of speaking, the whole man already lies swaddled in his cradle, end quote. So this is the idea. If you want to understand a modern nation, you have to look at its birth, locate it, and that will tell you a great deal. And this idea that the character of a nation or its spirit or its genius is to be found in a founding people. It's popularized in New England by John Quincy Adams, by Daniel Webster, people like that, and Bancroft. And it's not by chance that Bancroft has such an important role. Bancroft was this boy genius who graduated from Harvard at age 14, and then went to Germany. He was in Germany between 1818 and 1822, and he studied, took courses from Planck on church history, from Weckler on Tacitus, studied theology with Schleiermacher, history with Herer, who was a disciple of Herder, and it's not by chance that he himself also was interested in great ancestors in the spirit of the American people. And so what happens who are those great ancestors that are going to be praised in the United States? If you bracket out the first settlers of Virginia, who are often described as vicious and unscrupulous and not motivated by religion, and if you bracket out American Indians, you're left with the New England Puritans. And that's exactly what happened at the time. And I would argue that Bancroft would do for America what Tacitus had done for the Germans. He would rehabilitate the Pilgrims, mocked and denigrated by Enlightenment philosophers, and I should add, superbly ignored by the founding fathers. The Federalist Paper, I cannot think of a single reference to the Pilgrims. So in a way, it's a national triumph of New England historiography. And the climax, of course, takes place in the cabin of the Mayflower, where I cite Bancroft, humanity recovers its rights and the birth of constitutional liberty takes place. And I'm talking about Bancroft, but Tocqueville, read Tocqueville also on the Mayflower Compact. He's very enthusiastic about it. And in a note which was rediscovered recently by Nola, I think, Tocqueville even compares the Mayflower Compact to a genuine social contract in the lines dreamt by Rousseau, end quote. Now, of course, modern historians have questioned the centrality of the Mayflower Compact, which in many ways was an act of circumstance to prevent a near mutiny aboard the Mayflower that opposed the strangers and the saints, and not the creating foundation of a modern constitution. And really, it's at this time, I think, that the Pilgrims and the Puritans displace the importance of the Founding Fathers. Founding Fathers are not forgotten, but they are less significant. They are less important. Now, let me now consider in the 20th century, 21st centuries, the revival of those two, or the modernization of those two narratives. In the 20th century, I would argue that the secular narrative really reappears in strength in the court system, and the most remarkable example is the famous Everson decision, 1947, when Justice Hugo Black rereads the Virginian debates, rediscovers Jefferson's letter to the Baptist community of Danbury, and that decision does two things. First of all, it applies the Establishment Clause to the states through the doctrine of incorporation. And secondly, because it's based on an extraordinary historical approach. I'm not saying Hugo Black is a good historian, but that's the way he proceeds. He will cite Jefferson's letter to the Baptist of Danbury, and Everson has the famous quote, which, quote, "The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be high and impregnable. We would not accept the slightest breach," end quote, which in fact may not quite apply to the case that's at stake, but that's besides the point. That's the quote. And so how did that happen? Well, interestingly enough, Justice Black, in fact, is looking like any good justice case law, and the other case that's interesting for him is the Reynolds case of 1879, about a law that criminalized polygamy, and which is challenged by the Mormons. And in Reynolds, Chief Justice Waite is already citing Jefferson, reviving the debates about the disestablishment of the Anglican Church in Virginia. And so, in fact, Justice Black copies, in many ways, the historiographic work of Justice Waite a little before. And why Waite was so interested in forgotten 18th century documents or Jefferson's letter to the Community Baptist of Danbury? Well, simple response has to do with life in Washington, D.C. It happens that the neighbor to Justice Waite was George Bancroft, who fed him with documentation about what had happened then, and hence this new passion for rediscovered Jefferson and Virginia debates. Now, in a more recent period, I would argue that today the true guardians of the wall of separation between church and state are federal judges and justices of the Supreme Court, and especially progressive justices of the Supreme Court. But it's a jurisprudence that has evolved. I would say you have on one side separatists, on the other anti-separatists, and a further complication, but I will not mention that in my talk. We could talk to it later, so-called accommodationists who are kind of in between. But let me give you an example of a separatist. Justice Souter in McCreary County versus ACLU, that's a 2005 decision. It's about the posting of the King James version of the Ten Commandments in two courthouses in Kentucky. Justice Souter insists that a religious display, whatever its nature, whether it's a cross or the Ten Commandments or a crash, a nativity scene, cannot be tolerated in a public space if, and I quote him, actually it's a quote that he takes from an earlier decision given by O'Connor, but it's a quote which you find on and on again in cases that I would characterize as separatist. And the quote is the following. It cannot be tolerated if it sends the message to non-adherent, that is to say non-Christians, that they are outsiders, not full members of the political community. And so the overarching principle there is that of neutrality. Souter insists that the First Amendment mandates governmental neutrality between religion and religion, and between religion and irreligion. Now, look at a quick look at the revival of this other narrative that I call the neo-Puritan narrative. Three examples of this in the courts, in the court system, in political science, and in mainstream politics today. First example in the court system, you find there the opinion of those I call the anti-separatists, and a good example is late Justice Rehnquist, but it's also probably Thomas aujourd'hui, today, and Scalia. And basically, the position is the following, that the United States is a Christian nation, or at least is a nation built on solid Christian principles. And here's the way Rehnquist rewrite history. It's a very strange way. Let me quote him. The fact that the founding fathers believed devotedly that there was a God and the rights of man were rooted in him is clearly evidenced in their writings from the Mayflower Compact to the Constitution itself, end quote. A strange way to collapse two quite different historical epochs in a very short sentence. It's perfect, and to see or to imagine a perfect continuity from the Mayflower to the Constitution itself between the 17th century and the 18th century. Here's a justice who doesn't realize that the creator of the Declaration of Independence is not the jealous God of the Old Testament who punishes and condemns. And there's a wonderful book on this question of who is the creator of the Declaration of Independence, a book Walter Burns wrote, and it's called Making Patriot. In fact, the God of the Declaration of Independence is very much a fictitious God who gives rights and then disappears, and who defines, develop the rights. It's the sovereign people. The real legitimate authority is that of the sovereign people, period. So who is Jefferson's God? Well, who knows? But let us remember that he wrote the so-called Jefferson Bible, the life and morals of Jesus extracted from the gospel. It's very much a cut and paste operation where all the miracles and the resurrection disappear. And by the way, there's going to be an exhibition here in D.C. organized by the Smithsonian, where they will present a restored version of this Bible. Hopefully they will show the last page of the Bible, because it ends the following way, quote, "And Joseph rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed," period. That's the end of that Bible. And by the way, it was published very late in the 19th century, republished by the Congress in 1904, and given by the Congress for free to each new elected member of the Congress in 1904. Now, what about in political science? I see a revival of that same narrative in different works, and let me just refer to one. That's the work of the late Professor Huntington in a book called Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity, 2004. And here what we find, very much like what Rehnquist had done, an attempt to collapse the time of the Puritan and the time of the founders. And in fact, Huntington even forged the strange expression of the founding settlers, and I've never seen it elsewhere. And that's part of this potpourri that he calls the American Creed, and where he, I think, exaggerates the importance of the Puritan experience and diminishes or de-emphasizes the significance of the founding fathers' phase. And he says, one quote, "Religion has been and still is central, perhaps the central element of the American identity." And by the way, one of the implications of that book is that Hispanic immigrants cannot really be assimilated because they are reluctant to accept the American creed. I'm afraid there that Huntington exaggerates and has forgotten nearly a century of American history demonstrating that Irish Catholics Italian Catholics had a hard time to be assimilated themselves, and I have a chapter on the Bible wars in the book. I think we've forgotten how violent, how disruptive were those Bible wars. And then thirdly, the revival of the neo-Puritan narrative in mainstream politics, and we have beautiful examples of that today and every day now with the primaries. Michelle Bachmann, for instance, Governor Perry, Herman Cain, all pretend that all insist on the fact that the nation is a Christian nation. Governor Herman Cain keeps talking about the city on the hill, and it's not a new thing. Huckabee in 2008, for instance, expressed a desire to Christianize the Constitution in changing the preamble. Both Perry and Beckman today and Herman Cain are convinced the American government was founded on biblical principle, and that the Constitution is really a Christian document deliberately misread by secular humanists. And we can multiply the example, the influence of the late Scouser, for instance, in Washington, D.C. There's a seminar that's run by the National Center for Constitutional Studies, which claims, again, that the Constitution is a Christian document. And it's like reading a caricature of Bancroft, but there are lots of similarity between Scouser and Bancroft. And that seminar is attended by members of the Congress, or by elected members of the Congress. But, of course, the revival of the neo-Puritan narrative did not happen by chance. I mean, it's not a new phenomenon. I think it has to be replaced in its historical context, and that context, I think, has a lot to do with the Southern strategy of the Republican Party, which I see as reaching a climax under the Carter's administration, when the moral majority will not take over, but will be really very, very influential in that party. So let me conclude maybe with a brief reference to French perceptions of America. Now, a problem that we have in France today, and surprisingly enough, it seems to me that French elites have a harder time to understand the United States today than at the time of Voltaire, even though travel is easier, information circulates, and so on. And I think the problem is the inability of the French to understand evangelicalism, as if the first and second revivals had never taken place. And I think it has to do with the fact that we are very much a secularized society, which has maintained a Catholic culture. And this Catholic culture is based on respect for order, hierarchy, or fear of openly expressed emotions, fear of religious entrepreneurship. Not a new phenomenon. I mean, take Tocqueville. He has no problem dealing with the Puritans as an abstract object of history. But when he visits the United States, when he attends camp meetings in the early 1830s, he's kind of disturbed and horrified by what he sees, and he writes very much like Trollope, not so much in Democracy in America, but in another text, one of which is called Sects in America. And Tocqueville sees a dual threat for the future of the American democracy, the threat of skepticism or atheism that could lead to rebellion and socialism, perhaps, And on the other hand, the threat of an excessive, emotional, undisciplined religion, which could lead to anarchy, and he calls that the spiritualisme exalté. He finds it dangerous. And there's something striking with Tocqueville, because the point of departure of American democracy is the New England experience, but the point of arrival when he visits the United States is a time when Methodist and Baptist churches are spreading all over, and this is something that he has a hard time understanding. On the other hand, someone like Michel Chevalier, a student of Saint-Simon, who writes letters, Les Lettres sur l'Amérique du Nord, in 36, 2 years after Tocqueville, 1 year after Tocqueville, is the only Frenchman, to my knowledge, who has a positive reading of evangelical meetings. And his reasoning is the following. I mean, he attends a wonderful description of democratic political meeting, and he finds them boring and dull because you only have men there. And then he goes to camp meetings where he finds women have a central role. They are true participants. They also give speeches and so on. And he finds that truly exciting. And he says, you know, real democracy in America, it takes place in the camp meetings, not in the street before a democratic or Whig election. So he's the only one that seems to understand the importance of evangelicalism in the United States. And surprisingly, in a way, Tocqueville, because that's right before the beginning of the Bible Wars in the United States, Tocqueville imagined a solution to the American dilemma, a kind of moderate, for him, the ideal religion would be a moderate form of Catholicism compared to the one that he has observed in America and that he'd like to export to France, which doesn't have this moderate form of Catholicism at the time. And as he puts it, a form of religion that, quote, fixes the principle of the moral world and create, quote, habits of restraint, a kind of an in-between solution, if you wish, between radical skepticism and excessive evangelical religiosity. But his larger project, of course, is to modernize the French Catholic Church and the French democracy. Now, last word, I could, how much time? I could talk about Obama and religion. That may be too long. Okay, but last words then about French perception today. I think there's a constant pattern today in France, which is that when we don't understand what happens in America, we blame Puritanism. Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre did it in 1945. That's when the stereotypes become fixated, and it's very strange to visit American campuses, and they're absolutely convinced that both of them, students are Puritan even in their sexual activities. Bernard-Henri Lévy, who pretended to be a new Tocqueville, traveling the same path as Tocqueville and published his impression in American Vertigo, goes to a brothel in Nevada, which, of course, Tocqueville would never have done, and is surprised to discover that, quote, American prostitutes have behaved in a Puritan way. So the French obsession with Puritanism denotes, I think, fundamental lack of understanding of the transformation of religion in America, and it reveals a complete ignorance of the complexity of American politics. Not everyone is a fundamentalist in the United States or a victim of Puritan prosecutors. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, after all, was not condemned by a Puritan court or victimized by a Puritan prosecutor, as initially pretended by the French press. And when it comes to the debate today opposing, say, Rick Perry to Mitt Romney, it's too subtle, too sophisticated for French observers. They do not understand evangelicalism. We do not understand Mormonism, even less. And when we hear that Mormonism is a cult, I think it adds confusion to confusion for French observers, or for the French press, at least. And so, but maybe the best observer understands that tolerance matters, after all, in America, as it does or should in France. And in fact, I believe that Jefferson was right when he argued that, quote, it does me no injury to say there are 20 gods or no god, as long as they don't pick my pocket or break my leg. I think that's perhaps the best possible definition of government neutrality. Thank you.
Well, Denis Lacan, thank you so much for that lucid and concise summary of a book that is not simple to summarize concisely. So I think everybody in the room appreciates that. And now for a commentary, Professor Denine.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you very much for the invitation to participate in this discussion today. I'm particularly grateful for the opportunity to read a book that I had on my list of things to read, but forced me to sit down and read it, and it was a remarkably valuable and enlightening experience. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to reflect on it on this occasion. As Monsieur Lacan described to us, he suggests that there are two traditions in America. So let me just give the briefest summary of what I think he's done a wonderful job of describing. The first of these he describes as the Enlightenment tradition that informs the creation of the political architecture in America, primarily and focused on its constitutional order, but preceded by the Declaration of Independence and manifested in the thought of our founding fathers. This is a tradition that derives from secular sources, insists upon republicanism, upon a basis in reason. It cannot be understood to be a form of Orthodox Christianity. He points, of course, to Voltaire and Thomas Paine, as well as Thomas Jefferson, as representing this tradition. He suggests that this project aims at, and I quote, building a prosperous nation, that it didn't seek necessarily a religious nation or orienting us toward the city of God, but rather directing our attention toward what could be accomplished here on earth. And he argues that the founders had, quote, little interest in the religious past of the United States. And as he suggests, and I think Bill can confirm, he has this copy of the Federalists there, the Federalists don't mention the Puritans, at least as far as your index suggests. The second of these, and I list these in some ways chronologically out of order because for a specific reason. The second of these is the Puritan, or it draws itself understanding from the Puritan settlement, so that it's not the Puritan settlement. Rather, it's the understanding or interpretation of that settlement as particularly it was reconstructed in the 19th century, again, as you heard, particularly through figures, historians like George Bancroft. In fact, Professor Lacan suggests that the Puritan founding itself had little direct influence on the founding principles of the United States. And here he's taking issue with his countryman, Alexis de Tocqueville, who argued that, in fact, it was the Puritan settlement that, in fact, deeply informed the democratic and political sensibility of the Americans. So I want, in fact, to agree substantively with much of the main claims that are laid out in this book, and I think he does a really masterful job at laying out these two main streams of American political thought. But I want to suggest that these are right as part of a different narrative. I want to take issue actually with the narrative that he lays out here. So what I want to suggest, and I'll lay out front my counter thesis, is that the founders were generally of the kind that he describes, not Orthodox Christians, indeed attempting to set up a Republican a regime based extensively upon assumptions of that one could draw from the Enlightenment tradition, John Locke in particular, but that they were not uninterested in religion. And that indeed they were deeply interested in religion and saw religion as central to their project precisely because they understood in ways that contemporary secularists do not that the liberal philosophy that could trace itself back to Locke itself requires religion as a support. So that's my first counter thesis. My second one is that the 19th century, and I think he's quite right about this, the 19th century does indeed forge a counter or a narrative that adopts much of the energy of the Puritan Calvinist past of America to craft a powerful narrative about American history. But I want to contend that when the word generally of Puritanism is invoked, it's not Puritanism. It is rather a transformation of Puritanism now to something very different and indeed in a direction and certainly a theological direction that actually rejects the main premises and assumptions of Puritanism. So in fact, what Professor Lacorne picks up in the 19th century and particularly the arguments of figures like Bancroft and others is a transformation and indeed a kind of co-option of the power of that narrative. In fact, ironically enough, that narrative, as I'll suggest, is actually put into the service of the Enlightenment narrative of the founders. It is actually adopted or even co-opted to serve as, in some ways, as a kind of energetic source of furthering the Enlightenment Project. And I would even suggest, although I probably won't have time, that it continues in many cases and in many capacities in continuing to do that today. So let me take each of my claims and turn in just a little bit more detail. In the first case, I want to suggest that that in the Enlightenment philosophy at its very origins, and certainly in its liberal manifestation, there was always a profound self-awareness and self-consciousness that the liberal project as a political project required religious belief. Now, it's religious belief of a certain kind. Professor LeCorn mentioned, and he mentions it in his book as well, the way in which the founders relied upon the philosophy of John Locke, in particular the letter concerning toleration, to lay out why there should be a separation of some kind between church and state. That is to say that the state could not compel belief, that there was a place and required to be a place for liberty of conscience, and therefore argued against establishment churches, but even in some fundamental way, state compulsion of how one should believe. But that's not to state that Locke is indifferent to religion. And I was struck that this part of Locke's argument is left out of Professor LeCorn's account. In the letter concerning toleration, Locke provides for several exceptions to his general argument about toleration. The first is that toleration cannot be extended to any religious belief that pays homage to a foreign potentate, a foreign leader. Now, how many religions can you think of that do that? Well, I can think of one. And they had wars over this, Bible wars over this, in the 19th century in America. This is particularly, without naming it, of course, is particularly directed toward Catholicism, which, of course, pays homage recognizes the authority of the foreign potentate of the Pope. And in particular, what we see then is the effort in some ways to tame religion within the nation state and to evaluate a religion's value and the extent to which it can be tolerated within the nation state. So religion can exist as long as it doesn't pose a challenge to the nation state itself. It's worth remembering that during the Mexican-American War, that more Irish fought on the side of Mexico, I'm sorry, more American Irish fought on the side of Mexico than the United States, because they were fighting for their church and not for their country. So Locke's concerns have a basis, right? That if one pays allegiance to a foreign potentate, it could undermine the national allegiance of those adherents. But there's a second exclusion in Locke's philosophy. There is to be no toleration for atheists, people who deny the existence of God. And this is particularly because of the requirements that attend Locke's understanding of the basis of human society, namely the social contract. When one has a conception of society based upon the social contract, one has to presume that people at some level are willing to honor the terms of the contract. And indeed, to the extent that that society that becomes based upon a set of contracts, a further set of contracts, one has to have the belief that those contracts will be honored. Now, Hobbes is able to get around any potential free riding or backsliding by asserting the existence of an all-powerful Leviathan, a Leviathan state that will be there to ensure the terms of the contract. Locke doesn't want that strong of a state. And so Locke argues that if you want to ensure adherence to oaths and to contracts, one must have some statement of belief in the existence of a God that will ultimately backstop one's promises. You have to have a salutary fear of condemnation in order to backstop those oaths and contracts. And without those, there's a danger of in particular, there's a fear that atheists will not honor those terms. Throughout the founding era, the founders, really almost to a person, articulate this Lockean thesis. Let me give you just one example of this. This is from George Washington's farewell address. And he writes in the farewell address, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity," right? So he's talking about political prosperity, "religion and morality are indispensable supports. Let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation desert the oaths which are the instruments of the investigations of the civil courts? How can we ensure that people will keep their oaths? Why do you have to swear on the Bible, or at least at one time you have to swear on the Bible, before you give testimony in court? And let us," this is a particularly interesting sentence, "let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, this is Jefferson, reason and experience forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. So some peculiar people may be able to argue for morality like Jefferson's Bible without resort to religion, without resort to miracles and the belief in the afterlife. But most people need it in order to maintain and obey their agreements. Well, I'm referring here to Washington some years after the establishment of the Constitution. Let me give one other piece of evidence much closer to Professor LeCorn's argument. He argues that that we see the expressions of the High Enlightenment in their earliest in some of the state constitutions. So he talks in one of his chapters, he mentions in June of 1779, for example, the Massachusetts legislature called on all men 21 and older to form a convention to adopt the articles of a new constitution that was later to be adopted by two-thirds of the same electorate. According to Thomas Paine, these new electoral practices revealed the birth of a new grammar of liberty. The constitutions of the new American states were to liberty what grammar is to language. Right. He goes on to argue, Professor LeCorn, that the Massachusetts Constitution was a political document, an artifact produced by the delegates of the people meeting in the Constitutional Convention, as would be the case later in the Constitutional Convention of the United States. Now, I have my handy copy of my United States Constitution, which looks like a Bible. It's even got the little ribbon bookmark in it. But this little copy I like because it also has the Massachusetts Bill of Rights adopted in 1780, as exactly when this period exactly in which Professor LeCorn is talking about. So let me read Article 1 reads as follows. All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which must be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, acquiring and possessing and protecting property, in fine, seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. Okay, if I put that down right now, I'd say, yes, that's John Locke. Let me read Article 2, right after that one. It is the right as well of the duty as the duty of all men in society, publicly and at stated seasons, to worship the Supreme Being, the great creator and preserver of the universe. Okay, stop there. So, immediately after the Lockean statement, it is a duty, a requirement, that everyone be required to worship the deity. Now, this is the document that Thomas Paine calls a new document or a new grammar of freedom. This is Thomas Paine's whitewash, in some ways, of what's actually happening here. There was a deep understanding that even the Enlightenment philosophy required an obligation to belief in God. And this is not only the Massachusetts Constitution that argues this. If you look at the state constitutions of Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, all ratified in 1776, of New York and Vermont in 1777, of South Carolina and New Hampshire in 1784, as well as the earlier state constitutions of Connecticut, you will find effectively in slightly different language the same requirement, an obligation to worship the deity, or that the rights of people would be protected so long as they acknowledge the existence of God, that the rights cannot be secured without acknowledging the existence of God. And I could read these at some length. I have copies with me here. I won't take up the time, but I'm more than willing to give further evidence of this. It's, I think, here also that there's a potential to misunderstand the Constitution, which, as Professor LeCorn states, does not have an invocation of religion, but it doesn't need to. The Constitution is designed to do certain things. And so the First Amendment, which is particularly often looked to as establishing the high wall of separation, it does establish a wall of separation between the federal government and the states. As it was originally understood, the First Amendment is written, the Congress shall make no law regarding an establishment of religion, which is to leave all of the state establishments in place. It's precisely written not to create separation, but to protect the religious establishments where they existed at the time. The Congress won't fool around in what exists now in the states. So the Constitution didn't need to state a belief in God because it existed throughout the states at this time. And it's only with the Everson case, in which the First Amendment is incorporated, that suddenly now the states are barred from a state, any form of state establishment. So the narrative of the Enlightenment is a complicated one, and I think deeply complicated by the fact that religion is always understood as a necessary support for the Enlightenment project. It's never separated in the way that I think Professor LeCorn wants to suggest. Secondly, and I'll try to do this quickly, the Puritan narrative, and here I agree, is very much a crafted narrative in the 19th century, but in fact represents a kind of theological revolution. I would recommend to Professor LeCorn a wonderful book, which I didn't see in his index, by Ernest Lee Tuvison, a 1968 book called Redeemer Nation, The Idea of America's Millennial Role. And it's a wonderful book, those of you who are interested in this topic. What Tuvison really shows is how in the course, in particular, of in the 19th century, what had been what he calls the Augustinian interpretation of history that informed the Puritan founders or the Puritan settlers of America, which is to say that there's a strict division between the city of God and the city of man, that the city of man is a place of pilgrimage where we don't devote our entire loyalty. We're not to be, to understand ourselves as citizens of this world. We're to regard the world as in some way, a place we have to regard with a certain distance. That conception, that Puritan conception is transformed, but now called Puritan, transformed to what he calls a form of Christian optimism. It's transformed into now a narrative not about the difference between the city of man and the city of God, but rather that the city of God can be created through the city of man, and in particular that America has a providential place in the creation of the city of God. And this narrative is put to use among other places. One sees it in the theories and declarations of manifest destiny. Right. But one sees it now laced throughout the 19th century, ranging from articulations regarding America's expansion in the West, but you can still see articulations of it all the way to the current period. For example, the second inaugural address of George W. Bush, who argued that America has a place and a destiny in ensuring the freedom of the entire world. This language has never in some ways gone away, but what's notable is that it is adopted for the purpose of extending and perfecting the Hamiltonian project of national greatness. It's not Puritanism in its original conception, which is to say, to understand the strict divide between the city of man and the city of God. Rather, it's adopted. The energy is in some ways harnessed for the end of the perfection of the liberal state. Right? Even you could say it's a precursor and ultimately manifests itself in the progressive philosophy, among others, of Herbert Croly and John Dewey and Woodrow Wilson. So what I want to suggest, at least, is that Enlightenment philosophy and politics can coexist quite comfortably and compatibly, and has existed quite comfortably and compatibly, with religious invocations throughout its entire history in America. But only so long as it can be sufficiently made compatible with the broader liberal narrative. Right, so Locke has to ensure that religion can be reduced to or limited to the uses of the state. And this is the way in which the founders understand it. And the Puritan narrative can be revived in some sense so long as it can be oriented toward the end of national greatness. But where it cannot be adopted, then it becomes an object of hostility. And this is where I would suggest we see so many of our culture wars today. And where I would want to take issue, and I just want to do this very briefly, and he didn't have much of a chance to mention it, but maybe it's a chance for him to talk about it. I want to take issue with his concluding chapter in which he argues that President Obama can represent a kind of settlement of a faith-friendly secularism. And it seems to me that in so many areas that we're seeing today, especially in our cases coming up through the courts, we're seeing the very opposite. That it, particularly in those areas where religion exists in some way as a way or a form of behavior that exists now in contradiction to the broader liberal project, it now must be brought under the reign of, and indeed redefined by, the liberal state. I'll mention only, since it's in the news today, that the debate and issue that's going on right now with the Health and Human Service Department and its recent invitation to comment on its healthcare directives, and in particular that would more or less mandate to Catholic institutions that they provide abortion-fashioned contraception and other forms of what they regard as healthcare that would be in contradiction to those institutions. And there are very few exemptions that have been permitted in this most recent directive, and it seems to echo what we see taking place throughout the Obama administration, the decision by the EEOC ruling against Belmont Abbey College in an appeal by some of its staff and faculty that the school's prohibition on the absence of a contraception part of the policy in their healthcare plan was regarded by the EEOC as a discriminatory practice. That was a couple of years ago. More recently, so they were too Catholic. The National Labor Relations Board more recently determined that in the case of Manhattan College and one or two other colleges, that its labor policy or its effort to claim religious exemption due to its labor policy was inadmissible because it was not Catholic enough. That it was not actually devoted to a kind of Catholic mission. So there we see, I think, a growing number of cases, and in particular with agencies throughout the Obama administration, that really raise the question of whether or not one can see this as an administration in which we can see a kind of faith-friendly secularism, and suggest that where there are those aspects of religious belief that contradict the basic premises of liberalism, that those will ultimately come under the direct assault and confrontation of the liberal state. So, thank you.
Thank you very much for this very detailed discussion, and which could lead to another half an hour discussion. But very briefly, I will react to some of your maybe try to, first of all, avoid maybe a misunderstanding between the two of us. Perhaps it's something I said in the conference, but not so much in the book. I mean, for me, the secular ideal or secular enlightenment is not necessarily irreligious or anti-religious or atheist at all. Never forget that Jefferson and Voltaire, and who also disapproved of atheism, by the way, are deists. So religious values do matter for all of the people that I mentioned, including the founding fathers. And never forget that someone like Madison, for instance, the reason why Madison was so much involved in a disestablishment and lobbied for Jefferson in a disestablishment of the Anglican Church is the experience he had as a young man of observing Baptist ministers jailed because they were challenging the Anglican Church. And in fact, one could draw a parallel with Locke. Very, very nicely, you refer to Locke. Religions that he, well, two practice doesn't tolerate Catholicism on the one hand, atheism on the other. But regarding Catholicism and the denunciation of foreign potentates, you could argue that it was more or less the same situation with the Anglican Church, and there was a whole debate in the United States about the bishop, would the monarchy restore an Anglican bishop and a kind of tyrannical religion. So when you disestablish the Anglican Church in Virginia, you attack an official religion and a monarchy behind, which is very much like the Catholic Church. So that debate indeed explained the disestablishment trend. And by the way, on the cover of my book, there's Father Jacob Duché, who leads the prayer in the Continental Congress in 1774. Duché was the grandson of a Huguenot. His father was the mayor of Boston. 2 years later, when the Declaration of Independence is written, he leads the prayer again in the Congress of the United States and decides not to pray in the honor of King George, and is immediately arrested by the Brits as a traitor. So religion and politics can be a dangerous thing when the two are mixed. But so let me maybe lift the misunderstanding. I don't think that secularism is opposed to religion or to deism. And when you refer to the Massachusetts Constitution, for instance, very interesting, you mentioned the duty to worship a supreme being. Indeed, but that's a deist God. It's not Jesus Christ. It's very, very different from the way politicians talk today about their belief in the loving Christ and so on. It's a deist God, and it's a very different kind of conception of religion. And by the way, the founder of French laïcité, Ferdinand Buisson, who was very much involved in the nationalization of French private schools and created the public educational system. He was the advisor to Jules Ferry. When he created his, you know, the inventor of French laïcité defines it, and I refer to him in the book, as the neutrality of the government. But when he created those public schools and that ban religious teaching and the teaching of religion, he insisted nonetheless that in a secular private school in France, you ought to teach the duty towards God. So secularism is not opposed to reference to God, but it's always a non-clearly defined God. It's a God for all, except for atheists. It's not a Christian God. And I think it's a very important difference. I mean, deism, yes, but not Christianity. And that's where we probably we have problem today with politics today. And you, rightly so, you refer to the First Amendment and the fact that, indeed, the First Amendment does not apply to the states. It's really Congress shall not. So it is, and many commentators have insisted on that. However, I find it very interesting that by 1833, there's not a single state with an established church anymore in the United States, as if the First Amendment, after all, had been applied to all the states. We didn't have to wait Everson to, in a way, if you wish, to apply to the states. Every single state, through popular sovereignty, decided by the date of 1833 that there would not be an established church in the United States. Whereas in the rest of the world, in Britain, for instance, you still have a Test Act as of 1839, and many other regimes have established churches. So there's something that's happening here which is kind of interesting, and that has to be explained in spite of the, indeed, the limited text of the First Amendment. And when Jefferson writes a famous letter to the Danbury Baptist community, there's no Marbury versus Madison. No one is deciding whether a law or a part of the Constitution is valid or not. And Jefferson is the president and is asked his advice by Baptist from Connecticut, and he suggests that, well, yeah, that means that there's a wall of separation. But basically the message that Jefferson gives to the Baptists of Connecticut is fight the way we fought in Virginia. Try to get rid of this established church, and which finally will happen after a number of years. Last point, perhaps, I think a very interesting comment that you made, and which is right, is the distinction often between morality and religion. Now, I think you suggested that Jefferson, and I would say the same of Tocqueville. Now, Tocqueville is someone who lost faith at age 17, was a skeptic, probably an agnostic, if not an atheist himself. And Tocqueville thought that nonetheless, lack of religion was not something that was acceptable for a people. It's too dangerous. It leads to anarchy. You don't want that for an entire people. You want a morality, and the only way to have a sound morality for a people is to have something based on religion. So Tocqueville's argument, and perhaps Jefferson and many other founders, is that even though as a philosopher we could have doubts about religion, it's not a favorable thing to expand for an entire society, because then you will have something uncontrollable. And therefore, there should be morality, and the only possible base for morality is some reference to religion or to God or to a deity or the duty, the so-called devoir envers Dieu that were so praised in Europe by the inventor of French laïcité. So I think you're right. I mean, one should not draw too sharp a distinction between secularism and religion. And also one should not forget that when the founding fathers talked about the wall of separation, they were essentially also representing the interests of minority religions in Virginia, Baptist versus the Anglican Church, which was also people who voted for them. I mean, Jefferson would not have been elected without the vote of the minority religions, as opposed to Federalists, who very much counted on established churches and attacked Jefferson as an atheist who, if he were elected, would burn the Bibles in public. And, of course, that never happened. So you're right. There's more things are not as simple as I suggested in the talk. I think in the book it's a little more complex, and I do suggest that you cannot draw such a sharp line between secularism, secularist values, and non-secularist values.
Well, thanks to both of our speakers for a true intellectual banquet that's been laid before us. Brookings has been in existence for 95 years, and I would bet that there were some names mentioned in this room this afternoon that have never been mentioned once in the previous 95-year history of Brookings, and it's a testimony to the scholarship and erudition of both our speaker and our commentator. Not at all. I was riveted to the details, and I think the audience was as well. It is with extraordinary difficulty that I restrain myself from intervening in this discussion. But that would be wrong in all sorts of ways. I think that since we started a little bit late, we will continue this discussion a few minutes past the appointed witching hour. And so the remaining time is yours. I have only a few requests. First of all, wait until the roving microphone reaches you after I've called on you. Secondly, please do stand. That improves audibility. Third, identify yourself. A name will do, but an institutional affiliation if you wish. And finally, though no doubt there are people in this room who are very capable of making long and interesting interventions, please state a brief question. That would be most valuable. Thanks. Who wants to start? Well, I will start in the front of the room, proceed to the middle of the room, then the back of the room, and then come back. Yes.
Thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I think it's significant that we're having this session days after the death of Steve Jobs, because had it not been for him, in order for me to ask this question, I would have to say, as a longtime student of the Massachusetts Constitution of 1860, I have the following question. However, I'd never thought about it until Professor Deneen mentioned it. So I went to my iPad and looked at Articles 1 and 2, which I thought were interesting, but I want to ask you about Article 3, which I found, as I was leaning in the direction that it seemed to me Professor LaCorne was going, which was that the mentions in Article 1 and Article 2 were sort of less theological and more as a God without much... first of all, not using the word God very much, and second, in a sort of non-religious way. But then you get to Article 3, which I won't read in the interest of time, but just to say that in Article 3, God is made very specific. In the last paragraph, it says, "And every denomination of Christians demeaning themselves peaceably and as good subjects, blah, blah, blah." In Article 3, the legislature is instructed to create funds to create churches, etc. So my questions are twofold. One, is this still operative today? And second, if it isn't, where are those smart staff people for people like Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann? Because it seems to me Article 3 of the Massachusetts Constitution is the most explicit thing I've seen that says that church and state are, in fact, go together like love and marriage.
Well, you know, you have the Constitution in your
hand. I unfortunately, I only have that.
Could you refer to which version of the Constitution, the one you quoted?
Was this is 1780.
Oh, 1780.
Right, so that Thomas Paine said has been washed of all religious mention. I'm sorry?
How many constitutions
since 1780 in Massachusetts?
Oh, I wouldn't be able to tell you. Do you know? I don't know the specific history of the Massachusetts Constitution. I would rather assume that this is no longer operative. And if it is, you have a court case right there. I think this Constitution I'm certain has been superseded.
Well, you're
it's been rewritten.
1860, right?
What I do want to say is, and in response to Professor LaCorne, is that while it's true that many of the state constitutions mention an obligation to worship God, there are at least, again, I realize I left the actual copies that I'd made, at least half of them that refer explicitly to Christian. So it's true that they don't name a denomination of Christianity, but there's an expectation that it be Christian. The Vermont state constitution actually requires a inculcation in faith, hope, and charity, no less. So I think in fact it's one can't characterize this certainly as merely ceremonial deism, and I would further push that it's not merely deism in the sense that God creates the world and leaves the stage. God is still obviously there's a complex theology that's held by a number of different founders, but God is still, for many of the founders, God is still a presence. And Locke's conclusion that the social contract or oaths and contracts could be violated with ease by atheists assumes a punishing God. It assumes a God who's still invested in and cares and pays attention to the stuff of the world. Let me read just one other. You suggest even the declaration and the invocation of God and nature as God as deist. What does one make then of the concluding sentence of the declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence? It seems to me that this is a God who's still in the world and a God who still cares about our actions in the world.
But on Locke and prohibition on atheism, I mean, there's a ongoing debate among historians about Locke, about Pierre Bayle, who at the same time doesn't ban the atheist from the city as opposed to Locke. And it's been argued by recent historian, I think John Marshall and others, that Locke, in fact, was in pushing for toleration. Toleration was often perceived as a sign of atheism to protect himself. At the time, it was pretty dangerous to write a toleration, had to write a chapter that was less favorable to atheists. Because the problem, I think, with the Lockean reasoning is that we know a lot of, faithful Christians who reneged on their contract, and they don't seem to fear the ultimate punishment. And in fact, Locke recognizes non-Christian religion, the religion of the Indians, for instance, are perfectly valid. And there's no fear of eternal damnation if you violate your contract among Indian tribes. So why would Locke recognize the possibility of pagan faith, where there's no fear of ultimate damnation, and then reject the atheists? So maybe the discussion is not finished there. And the contrast with Pierre Bayle, who accepts atheists, and Locke, who doesn't, or Voltaire, who doesn't, merits, I think, a further discussion. Yeah.
Then, of course, in your book, Denis, you reproduce a wonderful passage from Roger Williams, who explicitly asserts that the moral behavior that civil society requires is imaginable even in the absence of religion. So that thought is abroad in the land. Whether it was the dominant tendency, who knows? I will now go to the middle. Yes.
Okay, I'm Norman Birnbaum from Georgetown University. One of the interesting things, when one reads biographies of...
Can people not hear? Is there a problem with these handheld microphones? Is it on? Well,
right,
hold it as close to your mouth as you're comfortable.
Well, short of swallowing it, it's...
Yeah, right.
One of the interesting things about American history, when one reads biographies or histories of certain groups, is that the very process of secularization has religious colorations for different groups. I was raised in a New York City family where John Dewey and Charles Beard were iconic figures. And then when I went to college, I read Matheson and Perry Miller and got a very different view of American history. But in fact, Beard and Dewey represented different paths to secularization. And I wonder whether in the end this doesn't lead to the interesting phenomenon that in terms of national self-interpretation or arguments about national self-interpretation, the United States is perhaps not a nation but a church.
Or as Chesterton said, a nation with the soul of a church. I'm going to take that as a comment rather than a question. And I will, you all proceed here. Yes, sir.
Bill Friend, formerly of George Washington University. My question is, I'm puzzled by the emphasis on Bancroft sort of amalgamating the Puritan tradition into the 19th century. I mean, this is a writer. But at the same time, the Great Awakening departs extraordinarily from the kind of conservative Calvinism that characterizes later and even contemporary American fundamentalism. And is it really the same thing? Later on, they may get mushed together, but is American fundamentalism really much connected to the Puritan tradition? I wonder about that. So I'd like another couple of phrases, please.
No, you're right. I mean, there's no absolutely no direct connection. Part of the book insists, first of all, on the fact that there's a very important moment in the United States when Calvinism is on the decline and progressively replaced. By the middle of the 19th century, the majority of American churches are evangelical. Calvinism is dead, basically. But that doesn't mean that historians who like to reimagine the past will exaggerate influences for the purpose of the present. I mean, it's a kind of retrospective reading of current history and in using things that are useful in the past. That doesn't mean that Calvinism is still a very alive phenomenon. And Bancroft himself is a very complex person because he himself is a Unitarian. He was trained to be a minister. He starts his career as a minister, but is not very successful and becomes an academic. Originally, he's a Whig, and then he becomes a Jacksonian Democrat. So it's very complicated, and Lillian Hendley does as well describe the complexity of the man. But I think originally he's marked by New England history, and he'd like to generalize it to the rest of the United States. And he's a kind of Michelet of the American Revolution, but a very different emphasis on the Puritan and the Mayflower Compact. And there's a whole literature. John Dietz has written on that, the Plymouth Rock, the importance it has in the New England culture and the displacement of the rock. I mean, there's historiography is fascinating because it's recuperating the past for present purpose, and I think the key message there was the moving beyond the Enlightenment and criticizing the cult of reason and the excessive emphasis on reason, and that's why I call it romantic. But if you look at someone like Tocqueville is not really a romantic, and Tocqueville is much more subtle. I mean, Tocqueville is a providential reading of history, but which is not as narrow as that of Bancroft, or Guizot, for that matter. Bancroft sees a kind of continuity from Luther to the Pilgrims, progressing religious liberties and freedom, and then finally constitutional freedom, which supposedly you find in the cabin of Mayflower. Tocqueville is more complex and subtle. For Tocqueville, the real phenomenon is not this kind of historical continuity from Luther to the Puritans. It's really the rise of equality, which is a much older phenomenon, which he sees starting with the invention of the gunpowder, the printing press, or even the Crusades, where lords would weaken their power and there would be more division of land and so on. The rise of equality is something which is anterior to the rise of Protestantism and leads to and continues under his eyes. So it's a time when you have a providential reading of history. But even the meaning of what is the provenance varies according to authors. For Guizot, for Bancroft, even for Huntington, it's really the Protestant providence, the Reformation and its modern expression. And for Tocqueville, it's a vaguer phenomenon that has to do with the unstoppable rise of equality throughout the world.
This young man here in the green shirt.
I'll try to keep this short. My name is Zach Bays. My question is really kind of an overarching question on this topic, on the place, or I guess the role of, excuse me, of religion in America. And it kind of, I guess I'll paint it this way. I've read recently a book by Professor Bruno Latour, who you might be familiar with from Sciences Po, called We Have Never Been Modern. And in that, he takes issue.
Sorry, by whom? By
Bruno Latour?
Oh, Bruno Latour.
Yeah, Bruno Latour. And, excuse my French. But he takes, amongst other things, but really looks at the role of the Enlightenment Project and says that it's never really, this idea, we've never been modern, it doesn't exist in a sense that the sort of deification of reason itself has never really existed in a sense, and therefore there's always been hybrids. So I'm wondering to what extent you think that that religion and politics have always existed as a sort of hybrid synthesis, or whether or not there can actually be a true separation of church and state.
Maybe the best possible example of this entanglement of religion and politics is, you know, let's go back to the case that I mentioned, the Everson decision. I mean, on the one hand, you have Justice Black, who recites Jefferson's law of separation, but when you look at the content of the decision, it's very, very different. What is it about? It's about public funds for the transportation of students to private schools that happen to be, in most cases, in the case in question, Catholic schools. And Justice Black says it's fine. It's fine because it's the law is neutral. It applies to all types of transportation of all students to all kind of schools, even though we're talking 90% Catholic schools. And so Justice Jackson, in his dissent in the same opinion, laughs about it and says, well, you know, here's a guy who says, is like Julia in Byron's play. She says, I don't consent, I will never consent, and she consents. So you always have to take it with a grain of salt. I mean, separationists are never fully separationists, and anti-separationists may accept accommodation in the other direction as well. It's important for sake of clarity to distinguish the two, but when you look at the details, it's much more complicated and confusing. And the Everson case is, I think, a good illustration of that.
I'm now going to march backwards, as I promised, towards the rear of the room. Yes, sir.
Good day. My name is Steve Lowe. I'm a secular humanist, and having just returned from the annual meeting of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, I feel very interested in this topic. My question is, you mentioned at the beginning of your talk about how current-day politicians are permitted or required even to express their religiosity in order to become credible, I guess, to the electorate. And I guess I want to say or ask you, is it not so that a very particular version of religion is the only one that's accepted for that purpose, i.e. a very Protestantism, I mean, essentially. I mean, Kennedy, with his Catholicism, had to make, you know, a special speech in order to be acceptable. A Buddhist or an Islamist or a Muslim or, heaven forbid, a secular humanist, you know, could never be elected in the national politics in America. So is there not, in practicality, a sort of tyranny of Protestantism in American national politics?
Provocative question.
Yeah, first of all, I think there's what's interesting about American elections, there's always a kind of underground religious war that's taking place in America, in American, during American primaries, at least. Huckabee in 2008 suggested that, you know, there's a cult where Jesus is the brother of Satan, and I was to destabilize Mitt Romney, of course. And Mitt Romney gave, you mentioned Kennedy, well, that's quite interesting. Mitt Romney's important speech, I think it was in 2008 or maybe a year before, the key speech that he gave on religion is the anti-Kennedy speech. Kennedy at Houston made a very clear distinction between, or insisted rather on the necessity of a separation of church and state, on the neutrality of the government, and saying that even though he was a Catholic, he would not take orders from the church and would insist on secular values. And he had to do that to be accepted, particularly at the time, I think it was right before the West Virginia primary, which was considered the most Protestant state in the United States, and it was a deciding phase. Would he be accepted there or not? And if he did all right in West Virginia, then we Democrat leaders would accept him. Now, Romney did very much the opposite. Romney, who had a problem, still has a problem with evangelicalism, made a speech, if I recall well, as two enemies, the socialists, that's the bad guys, and the others are the secularists. And it's an attack on secularism, but which is designed to seduce the Protestant vote. So it's really a good example of the instrumentalization of religion. And you see the same thing today with this discussion on is there a cult or not. And, of course, people are thinking of Iowa and the elections in South Carolina where it happens that the evangelical vote is so important. But that has to do with another phenomenon, which I'd urge you to consider as well, which is the southernization of Republican politics, which is the southern strategy of the Republican Party, which has given this, has forced the Republicans to overemphasize religious values and fundamentalist values that are relatively recent in their historical, if you take a long historical perspective, but that's an inevitable consequence of this southernization of the Republican Party. But here what you're mentioning is, yeah, it relates to the instrumentalization of religion for political purpose, and this is just the beginning of it, I think.
Yes, the woman on the aisle.
Would you agree that many times the expression of Christianity as the key element, the descriptor of this nation, is really tied to other social issues? The same people who argued that all men were endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. However, if your color were black or brown, you may not even have a soul. There would be completely a different question. Concerning the Mormons with their exodus from Nauvoo, where they were an economic threat to the population in that area, you had another kind of social tension. So my question is, do we find a thread of the use of religion as a cloak for other issues that are posed that one feels is a threat to a community?
I wonder if I could respond to that. It seems to me that religion, like nearly any other technology, Steve Jobs, iPad, et cetera, can be used for ill and for good. And I think one can certainly invoke many occasions in American history when religion has been used to defend practices I think most of us would agree are egregious and reprehensible. But I think we ought not to forget that religion was also underlie a lot of the energy of the movement of abolition in this country, as well as the civil rights movement. So it seems to me that that characterization is a bit one-sided, and we need and what I appreciate about Professor LeCorn's book so very much is a much suppler understanding of this phenomenon of religion, or even if we want to, look at it in its more particular manifestations. The most recent the question before this on Protestantism. What exactly is that? We need to become much more theologically literate, and if we really want to grasp at and get a better understanding of this phenomenon, we can't use these blanket label categories. You have to dig down in some depth and understand not simply, if the language of Puritanism is used in the 19th century, you need to look at the theology that's being invoked in that. I would be cautious about any of those kinds of blanket statements. I think that's been the cause of too much damage in our political dialogue today.
We are very close to the end of this event. I have an announcement to make, and that is that Professor LeCorn's wonderful book is on sale in the rear of the room. And my guess is that he would be willing to inscribe it if you were willing to purchase it. It's an irresistible deal. Let me just wind up this fascinating session, with a question that I think both of you, can and should respond to. The book indicates, I think, very forcefully and persuasively that yes, indeed, there is a huge gulf socially and theologically between Puritanism in its original form and the rise of evangelical Protestantism in the 19th century. And the book goes on to say that evangelical awakening represents, and I quote, the democratization of American religion. I think that is absolutely right on many, many different levels. And here's my question. Alexis de Tocqueville was the great tracer of the influence of the spirit of democracy on every single facet of American institutions and American society and American mores. That being the case, and given the fact that he's perfectly capable of decoupling his analytical findings from his preferences, and he's quite capable of seeing that the onward march of the democratic spirit does some damage as well as some good, why, in your judgment, did he find it so difficult to take on board the evangelical awakening as yet one more instance of the inexorable democratization of the American spirit in all its works and ways? That is perhaps, you know, a man who's famous as a prophet, that is perhaps one of the most signal instances of a prophetic failure in Tocqueville's entire oeuvre.
I go first, since I want to give you the last word. it seems to me that there's one argument in Professor LeCorn's book, that one argument of Tocqueville's that he dismisses rather summarily, and I think is worthy of revisiting. And on that chapter in which Tocqueville addresses the rise of what is at this time the Second Great Awakening, what he calls spiritual or religious enthusiasm, and this seems to me remarkably in the way in which Tocqueville often predicts, not only sees things that are happening, but predicts things that are to happen. He argues that we need to understand this phenomenon, this kind of religious madness in American society, in a way that's not disconnected from the deep materialism of American society. That is to say, he sees these as two forces joined at the hip, or you could say two sides of the same coin. That the profound materialism that he sees driving American restlessness, the move, the march westward, our obsession with, you know, what property we own, what are the signs of our relative prosperity, how we establish our worth in an egalitarian age in contrast to others. This deep materialism on the one hand provokes a reaction, on the other hand, of a madness, a spiritual madness that insists that in some ways we must devote ourselves to the things on high. And I think what Tocqueville's arguing is that we need that America needs a more measured way of putting together its tendency toward materialism and its tendency, its kind of corresponding tendency toward spiritual madness. And in that sense, I think Tocqueville's argument is one that Americans still should encounter, and I think describes so much of what we still encounter today.
No, I agree with you, but what is this most measured way that you're talking about for Tocqueville? It's a... Yeah, but it's also Catholicism. It's a moderate Catholicism. He sees it as the best, the religion that fits the best future democracy. And in a way, maybe right. I mean, there's a recent time when majority of the Supreme Court is made up of Catholic justices. In a way, you could find the rise of this Catholic, is it moderation, pure moderation, perhaps? But in a way, it's been, no, but the problem, I mean, let's be serious. When he writes, I think basically Tocqueville, perhaps because of the language problem, most of the religious leaders that he met were Catholic priests. Because at the time, you had a lot of French-speaking Catholic priests who were quite moderate and tolerant, and he had long discussions with them. And the few camp meetings that he visited may have been atypical of what was a typical Methodist or a Baptist church at the time. So maybe there was a disproportion between the number of Catholic leaders that he met who happened to speak French, and that was easier in Boston and Philadelphia and elsewhere, in New York, And he went, maybe he was too much of an anthropologist going into the woods, see camp meetings and having the thrill and the terror of what was happening. Maybe he was too much of a tourist, and maybe it's not by chance that his very harsh description of revivals are not, he decided in the end not to place them in Democracy in America, but in another text that has been published since then. So that would be my explanation. Whereas by the time Michel Chevalier comes, things are settled, and he didn't just go into the woods to find the crazy preachers. He met, I suppose, regular priests and ministers in the cities as well, and may have had a better vision or more accurate vision of what evangelicalism was all about.
Well, thank you so much, and let me end this event on a plus ça change note. I quote from a Federalist newspaper in 1800. For those of you who are shocked by the way Rick Perry was introduced by his Texas pastor, shall I continue in allegiance to God and a religious president, or impiously declare for Jefferson and no God? So we're actually doing better than we used to. To say nothing of the fact that Mr. Perry's pastor implicitly acknowledged that a religious cult could produce a good and moral man. I consider that to be a significant concession. And now please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists.